filled in the gaps in my knowledge about her company, though she was tight-lipped and uncomfortable talking about herself. I did learn more about this interesting woman as she talked about her work, because it was so obviously a big part of her. Julie had worked in this field since she was a child, and seemed to know it very well. As the daylight fled, she started to glance nervously toward the window. I did not ask why. She was a veritable encyclopedia of monster-related knowledge, and she even let slip the fact that she had earned a degree in ancient history and a master's in archaeology because it pertained so much to her life's work. When I had asked why those particular fields, she explained that the battle did not start recently, and she left it at that. The open window kept drawing her attention. It was dark outside. Finally, I could not help but ask, "So why are you so distracted? What are you looking for?" Julie sighed and brushed back her long hair, looking relieved. She yawned, stretched, and stood, adjusted her jacket, and prepared to leave. She patted her gun to make sure it was properly holstered. "I've got to be going." "Why?" I asked, puzzled by the sudden change.
"You don't realize what tonight is, do you?"
she asked. "Thursday?" I answered helpfully as I grabbed my crutch and pulled myself out of my chair.
"I wonder if we stole the right file, because for a genius, you're not real fast on the uptake."
I shrugged. I had no idea. She grabbed my arm and helped me stand up. Julie looked me in the eye, and I could see my reflection in her thick glasses. Her brown eyes were beautiful.
"It's been 1 month since you were attacked. The test came back negative, but they're not always right."
She guided me as I hobbled over to the window. The full moon hung low and bright above the Dallas skyline. I realized now why she had stayed. Other than my still sore leg and healing muscles, I felt fine. I wasn't sprouting any hair, at least not any more than my normal prodigious amount. So it was a test?
"Nothing personal. We just had to make sure."
Oh, I could not think of anything to say. She had been prepared to kill me all along. We silently watched the sky. I realized that she was still holding my arm, standing close, and I could feel the warm, soft pressure of her body against mine. There together in the light of the moon, just the slight tenseness of her hands on the muscles of my arm, I could feel her breath on my ear. It was a good moment. I wished that it could last forever. Unfortunately, she was only holding me to keep my pathetic, crippled ass from falling down. Once she was sure that I was stable on my crutch, she let go. She reached into her purse, produced a card, and handed it over. The card had a set of directions, a very basic map, and a picture of a green, happy face with horns.
"We're putting together a training class. It's going to be brutally hard because we only hire the best. Once you have had a chance to think about it, if you're still interested, be at the location on that card in 3 weeks."
I put the card in my pocket. "I'll be there," I promised.
"Good. Welcome to MHI.
She shook my hand in a professional manner. "Thanks."
"I'll let myself out," Julie said.
She started to walk away, leaving me to watch the moon. Julie Shackelford made it a few steps, and then surprised me by turning around and coming back. I felt her full lips brush softly against my cheek in a brief kiss. Luckily, the crutch was well grounded, or I might have fallen head first out the window in shock.
"You're a sweet guy, Owen. Thanks for the nice dinner. See you in a few weeks."
Then she glided away. At least I waited for the confirmation of my front door closing before grinning like an idiot. It had been a good day after all. I had gotten some of my questions answered. I had found a new job, one that at least sounded interesting, even if it was a bit of a career change on the insane side. I had, in theory at least, a check for $50,000 in my pocket. And best of all, a pretty girl had kissed me on the cheek. Yes, it had been a great day indeed. I pulled the card and examined it. I was going to Alabama. Chapter 4. The next 3 weeks had passed quickly. The puff check had, surprisingly enough, cleared. And with a bloated bank account, I had packed my bags, sold or given away most of my stuff, broken the lease on my apartment, and driven to the middle of nowhere, following the directions that Julie Shackelford had left me. Everything that I still owned was stuffed into the back seat and trunk of my rust-brown Chevy Caprice. All I had was a couple duffel bags with clothing, my laptop, a few other supplies, and about a dozen guns. There was no way I was parting with those. It was a good thing that a Caprice's trunk is big enough to suit a mafia don. Julie's directions had been printed on a 3x5 card. Her parting instructions had been for me to meet at the location listed at a certain time and date. She had told me that food and lodging would be provided, but she had not given me any other details. I had driven straight through from Dallas to Alabama, thoughts of the absurdity of what I was doing nagging at me the entire time. "Welcome to the heart of Dixie," the sign on the border had proclaimed. I stopped once in Montgomery to pick up a better map. According to the card's directions, the place I was driving to was nothing but an almost blank green spot on the map with only one road and one small dot for a town. Cazador, Alabama. It took another 2 hours from Montgomery to arrive in Cazador, but a good half of that was spent driving lost through the forest. The trees were dense, and the underbrush was thick and still over the iron-red soil. The country around Cazador consisted of beautiful rolling hills, interspersed with many streams and creeks. The town itself was really more of a village. There were a few small stores, a Baptist church directly across from a Church of Christ, and a scattering of houses. The buildings appeared old and weathered. An old sign near the road read simply, "Cazador, Alabama, population 682. A slightly newer sign beneath stated that guided tours of the catfish plant were available from noon until 4. I'm sure that was a barrel of fun. I stopped for overpriced gas, a soda, and to scrape the bugs off my windows at the only convenience store in town. A few locals made eye contact, but nobody spoke to me. I overheard a toothless geezer murmuring to the cashier something about fresh meat. I didn't care to guess if he was talking about me or the lunch menu. Following the final directions on the card, I had taken a small, barely paved road through some more hills and into even deeper woods. It branched, and I kept to the west for another mile. I almost missed the gravel turnoff. My main indication that I had found the home of Monster Hunter International was a small sign painted with the letters MHI and a green smiley face. The smiley face had horns. As my car bounced slowly down the gravel road, I took note of the many "no trespassing" and "trespassers will be shot" warnings. Finally, I came to an open gate surrounded by a high chain link and razor wire. Near the gate, a man sat in a folding chair under the shade of a large umbrella, relaxed and apparently listening to a big battery-powered radio. He waved lazily as I braked and rolled down my window. He was an interesting-looking fellow, weathered to the point that it was difficult to guess his age, a little shorter than average, with a shaved head, small wire-rimmed glasses over a blunt, freckled nose, and a thick red beard that was absurdly long and pointy. The end had even been braided with a few decorative beads. He was wearing a Rush Tom Sawyer T-shirt, cargo shorts, and Birkenstock sandals.
He looked kind of like a granola-eating environmentalist type, except for the worn M4 carbine hanging idly from a tactical sling draped over his shoulder. He was spitting the remains of sunflower seeds into a cup.
"Hi, I'm looking for MHI, I said. The man adjusted his glasses and looked at me, head tilted at a slightly strange angle as he smiled absently. Suddenly, he clicked his tongue and pointed at me.
"Big dude. Scarface. You must be that guy Earl found. Threw a werewolf out a window?"
"That would be me."
I realized that the boombox was set to a talk radio station, and the subject was something to do with black helicopters and cattle mutilation.
"Julie Shackelford offered me a job."
"She does that a lot. We're a little short-handed right now, but that's a long story. Drive straight in, park in front of the biggest building. You're a little early, but a few other newbies are already here. The boss said that he would say a few words to you guys, so just hang out."
"Newbie?"
"New hire. Greenies. Monster bait. Organ donors, you know. It's slang."
"Oh, okay. I'm Owen Pitt."
I stuck my hand out the window.
"Milo Ivan Anderson. Jack of all trades. Master of couple. Call me Milo. If you live long enough, I'm the guy that gets to teach you how all the cool stuff works."
He shook my hand and grinned. His beard stretched halfway to his shorts.
"See you around."
I parked in the lot that Milo pointed out, locked the doors out of habit, and checked the surroundings. The MHI property could probably best be described as a compound. The main building appeared to be the only permanent structure, being constructed of heavy red brick and steel. It was an office building, but with narrow windows, obviously thick walls, and iron bars. It looked like it could pass muster as a fortress if the need arose. I wouldn't be surprised if there had been a big pot full of boiling oil just out of sight on the wide, flat roof. As I entered, I realized that the main doors opened into a small room that funneled down to a smaller set of doors. Suspended overhead was what appeared to be a heavy portcullis that could be dropped to seal the secondary doors.
"Very interesting."
An older lady was seated behind a massive reception desk. She smiled at me as I approached. At least the staff here was friendly. She had to be in her 60s, and looked plump and cheerful. She was wearing a matronly purple knit sweater, but the large frame revolver in her shoulder holster was printing pretty badly through the fabric.
"Hello, dear. You must be here for the orientation," she said.
"Yes, my name's Owen Pitt."
"Oh, I recognize you. You're the one that kicked that werewolf's ass. That was some mighty fine brawling, sonny."
Thanks, I guess."
"No, thank you. Earl showed us all that video. It was right entertaining. I hate werewolves. Used to hunt the sons of bitches once my own self. Used to could do a fair job in my day, till one of the bastards took my leg. This one here is plastic."
She knocked on her plastic leg for effect. It made a hollow noise.
"My old one was made out of wood, but it would swell up when it got humid. I reckon it does get mighty wet in these parts. No place at all for a wood leg. Could be worse. Old Leroy had himself a wood eye. Painted it brown, same color as the other. Summertime roll around, damn thing would swell till it would get stuck pointing one direction. Poor old Leroy. He was a good one. Oh, well. Sign in here."
My signature was quick and sloppy on the clipboard. As an accountant, you have to sign your name a lot. You try to keep a pretty signature when you have to sign it a couple hundred times a day. There were at least 20 names ahead of mine.
"My name's Dorcas. Some kids nowadays snicker at that name. But my ma said that it was a right fine biblical name, and it has suited me for close to 70 years. Any punk kids make fun of my name, I'll put my plastic foot in their ass. Got that, boy?"
"Yes, ma'am."
That was my instinctive response to crotchety old ladies. especially former monster hunters strapped with what appeared to be a .44 Magnum.
Good. Go down the hall. Double door on the right. That's the cafeteria and meeting hall. Now scat. I got business to conduct.
Yes, ma'am. I hurried away so Dorcas could continue her game of solitaire on the computer. As I strolled in the direction the receptionist had indicated, something caught my eye. I paused in front of a wall of small silver plaques. There had to be at least 400 of them, and they took up quite a bit of space. Not all of them had pictures, but all had a name, a birth date, and a death date. The oldest plaques mostly lacked photos, and the birth dates started clear back in the 1850s. It was a wall of remembrance for fallen comrades. There was an inscription in Latin carved into a large, polished board at the top of the wall. Sic transit gloria mundi. Being an auditor by trade, I could not help but notice the curious fact that almost 100 of the newest memorials shared the same death date, December 15th, 1995. Whatever had happened on that date must have been a black day for the hunters. Also strange, there was a span going forward from that day, with no new death dates, until a few in the current year. The 6-year gap was conspicuous by its absence. A group was waiting in the cafeteria. There were a few small pockets of conversation, but mostly they had pulled up chairs by themselves and were waiting nervously. Not being one for socializing, I grabbed a metal folding chair and took up residence in the back of the room. The fellow to my right was snoring loudly. To my left was a young Asian man, warily watching the others. He shook my hand and introduced himself as Albert Lee. When I asked him how he had ended up here, he muttered something about spiders. Big spiders. More people gradually arrived. To pass the time, I studied the others. I caught a few of them studying me back. The group was about 80% male, and I would guess that the average age was probably just under 30. Most of the newbies looked relatively fit, though surprisingly there were a few people I would call gravitationally challenged. The group was a good demographic cross-section of America, with the biggest numbers being Caucasian, but also some Hispanics, Asians, blacks, and a couple of people like me of indeterminate race. Don't bother to ask. My ancestors really got around. Finally, when I counted about 40 others in the room, I heard a voice bellow for everybody to quiet down and take a seat. Earl Harbinger paced back and forth at the front of the cafeteria. He was wearing the same leather bomber jacket, and he had the same intense presence as when I had first met him. Several other individuals entered and took seats behind him. I recognized Milo from the gate, and there was Julie Shackelford. She smiled when she saw me. My heart skipped a beat.
"Hello. My name is Earl Harbinger. Many of you know me already. I'm the Director of Operations here at MHI. Welcome to our new hunter orientation. Let's get one thing straight right off the bat. We hunt monsters. That's what we do. Every one of you has had the experience to realize that there is a lot more out there than you've been led to believe. In the coming days, I would just ask for one thing. Keep your mind flexible. Don't get caught up in what you're sure is real, because if you can't believe in them, you can't fight them."
Harbinger stopped speaking just as an older gentleman limped into the room. He was tall and gaunt. A black patch covered his obviously empty left eye socket, and the skin on that side of his face looked as if it had been badly burned at some point in the distant past. He had a stainless steel hook instead of a right hand. His hair was thick and white and had been neatly combed. He wore an obviously expensive, dark Italian suit. He walked slowly, one foot slightly dragging.
"Ladies and gentlemen, let me introduce Raymond Shackelford,
President and CEO of Monster Hunter International.
Harbinger quickly sat down. Most of us started to clap politely. The senior Shackelford shushed us and waved his hook in our general direction.
Enough of that nonsense. I ain't no politician.
He paused, folded his arms behind his back, almost as if he was at parade rest, and proudly addressed the room. He had the air of an old southern gentleman. The boom of his voice did not fit his frail appearance.
Welcome to Monster Hunter International. My name is Raymond Shackelford III. You can call me Sir, Mr. Shackelford, or Boss. Today you are going to get a little history lesson, so pay attention.
He cleared his throat loudly.
My grandfather founded this company in 1895, Raymond Shackelford I, but around these parts everybody knew him as Bubba. Bubba Shackelford was born and raised in this very valley, here in the heart of Keene County. One winter, the good folk of Keene County started to disappear. Sadly, some of them even came back, only they were not quite human anymore. My grandfather formed a group of concerned citizens, best could be described as an angry mob, and took care of the problem. The fault lay with what we now know to be a vampire. Grandpa Shackelford lynched the creature twice, and when it wouldn't die, they finally, in frustration, burned it at the stake. One by one, my grandfather's men found every newly created vampire and destroyed each in turn, until finally the county and Cazador Township was made safe.
The old man coughed, then pulled a white handkerchief from his suit coat and wiped his nose. It was plain to see that he was not in good shape, but it was obvious that he still maintained an amazingly strong will and presence. I had met a few people like that before, mostly at Veterans Day functions. They were the kind of men that even my father saluted.
Word spread across the state, and then across the South. Bubba's reputation grew. Turns out that there were many other towns that had had their own supernatural problems. Grandpa was offered what was, for the time, princely sums of money to travel and dispatch other monsters. As time passed, he assembled a group of strong men to assist him. They learned from their mistakes, and they improved their methods. In December of 1895, they formed Bubba Shackelford's Professional Monster Killers. It has a certain ring to it, doesn't it?
He asked rhetorically.
A contemporary of my grandfather was one Theodore Roosevelt. As luck would have it, Teddy, being an adventurous sort, had had a few monster encounters of his own, once as the New York City Police Commissioner, and then again in Cuba during the Spanish-American War. When Teddy became president, he was hell-bent on the creation of some means to keep the forces of evil in check. Thus, the Perpetual Unearthly Forces Fund was begun, or as we like to call it, PUF. This was intended as a bounty system to award entrepreneurial brave men who would aid the nation by destroying dangerous monsters. My grandfather was the first person awarded a PUF bounty. Since those early days, this company has led the way in the fight against evil. After taking big jobs in Mexico for Standard Oil and in the Caribbean for United Fruit, the name was changed from Bubba Shackelford's Professional Monster Killers to something considered a bit more respectable, Monster Hunter International. Grandpa's company grew in stature and wealth, and he was even offered a position of some authority with the government's newly created Monster Control Bureau. He turned it down because he hated the government and had vowed never to work for any Yankees.
There was some laughter at that.
Eventually, my grandfather died doing what he loved. His son, my father, took over the company at that time. He, too, was struck down. When I was old enough, I became the head of this company, and I have seen it change from a small operation into the premier monster-hunting organization in the world.
He suddenly coughed again,
this time with much greater intensity, a deep, racking hack that sounded painful and wet. He covered his mouth with his hook, and Julie quickly stepped to her grandfather's side to offer assistance. He gently waved her away, and, looking very concerned, she returned to her seat. He continued as if nothing had happened.
"For over 100 years, this company has fought the good fight, the noble fight. We have always fought in secret because the powers that be don't want the sheep to be scared. We are the sheepdogs, and there are wolves out there, as all of you know firsthand. But things have changed. We have entered dark times indeed. For a brief time, the fools in power, who should have known better, declared our business illegal. They caved in to monsters' rights groups and the bureaucrats who assured them that federal agencies could handle the problem. There was an executive order. We were shut down, our assets confiscated, and any of us who opened our mouths were threatened with jail time. The damn nanny state couldn't handle the idea of private citizens taking care of their business.
He was becoming visibly agitated. That explained the gap in the memorial plaques, but not what happened on December 15th.
Ha! Ignorant bastards just had to have their fingers in everything. Monster attacks went up 3,000% in the 6 years Puff was shut down. The government has long had a policy to keep the truth secret. That is why so many of you here today were paid visits by agents and threatened with physical harm if you talk too much. But with incidents going through the roof, they were not going to be able to keep the lid on for much longer. Even with the full cooperation of the media, word was starting to spread. Not all of those crazy folks on that internet thing are as crazy as you might think.
He grinned widely, obviously amused at that thought.
Once enough voters were getting eaten, Congress had had enough and pressured the next president to reinstate Puff and revoke the executive order that had banned professional monster hunting. So now we have restarted operations and are trying to move past our dark days. Unfortunately, we are short-handed, and the monster problem is out of control. We are spread thin, with only small teams of experienced hunters scattered around the country trying to put out fires. On the bright side, with so many attacks, it certainly makes finding and recruiting brave people like y'all much easier.
He gestured at us with his hook.
Thank you for coming. I look forward to working with each of you who make it through our training process. It will be hard. Earl here is going to be a mean one, but it's for your own good. I must be going now.
We all stood and clapped as he shuffled out of the room. Judging by the man's injuries and attitude, I was willing to bet that he was a student of the lead-from-the-front school of management. His savaged appearance was sobering, though, and I'm sure it made a few of the other newbies question wanting to try monster hunting as a career. Harbinger stood and addressed us again.
Every single person in this room was contacted after they survived some sort of monster encounter. Trust me, just surviving means that each one of you is statistically significant. We personally invited about double the number of people that you see here. Most of those decided not to come. That either makes you braver or maybe stupider than the others.
There were a few chuckles from the crowd.
I ain't joking, people. I'm going to be flat-out honest here. I'm sure you all saw that wall outside, the one with all of the pretty silver things on it. Each one of those represents a fallen monster hunter. There is just over 100 years of history on that wall. What we do is dangerous, sometimes stupidly dangerous, but it is necessary. More necessary than you might even realize for reasons that you'll come to understand with time. The only way that we win is if we work together as a team, and be every bit as tough and ruthless and clever as the things we're chasing. Many of you will wash out of training, or get kicked out if you ain't up to snuff. That's fine, so don't get hurt feelings. This job is not for everybody. There ain't no shame in quitting.
If at any time you decide that you want to quit, no problem. Talk to Dorcas. We'll write you out a check for your time, and there are no hard feelings. Keep in mind, however, that if you talk about us in public, the nice men from the Monster Control Bureau that most of you have already met will probably kill you. Harbinger moved like a predator, eyeing the group with unnerving intensity. Your teachers will consist of experienced hunters. Listen to them carefully. Read everything that you're given. Your life or the lives of your teammates may depend on your skill or knowledge. Harbinger pointed at the small knot of people sitting behind him. We're not normally teachers. The folks sitting behind me are actually my personal team. I trust each one of them with my life, and any of them would trust me with theirs. If any one of them decides that any one of you does not have what it takes to be a hunter, then you're gone. That is all. Don't screw around with us. We're much better killers than we are babysitters. I knew Julie, and I had met Milo briefly, but I had no clue who the others were. One instructor had a giant mustache, looked like a cross between a cowboy and a truck driver, and reminded me of Kenny's dad from South Park. Some of you are here because you're tough. Some are smart. Some are warriors. Some are not. It doesn't matter. Everybody will go through the same training. We recruited many of you because of your brains, and though you will probably never need to be on an actual hunting mission, you will still be trained to the same standards in weapons, tactics, and other skills. You need to understand the people you are supporting as good as you understand yourself. Those of you we recruited because you're fighters, you will need to learn every single bit of monster-related information that the smart folks learn. For those of you who think you are both smart and tough, don't get cocky, because you will probably be the first one to get eaten. A few people started to snicker at that, but most of us realized that it was not meant to be funny. I was feeling rather sober and slightly intimidated. Training will last until we decide that you're good enough. After that, you will be assigned to your duties. Some of you will be assigned to hunter teams. We have teams stationed all around the country. Those teams respond to crises as they develop. Other people will work in direct support of the teams. We will go into greater details about how this entire thing works as training progresses. Every employee will be paid bi-monthly according to your position. Any puff your personal team earns will be shared by the whole company, with your team getting the largest percentage. Think of it as profit sharing. That means that if your team wins a huge bounty, you don't get to keep it all. Be careful not to bitch too much about that, however, because the next week it will probably be some other team that wins the big one and not you. Don't worry, though. The lowest paid employee we have probably made more than most of you did in the last year. Our business is monsters, and business is booming. He showed a lot of teeth when he smiled. It almost reminded me of when Mr. Huffman was about to eat me. Any questions? It was quiet. I was positive that there were many questions, but everyone was afraid to ask. I debated for a moment, but once again, curiosity got the better of me, and I hesitantly raised my hand. Pitt, Harbinger pointed at me. What happened on December 15th, 1995? The instructors looked at each other uneasily. The pause was unnaturally long, and I realized from the creaking of folding chairs and the rustle of 40 separate adjustments that the whole room was looking at me. How did you know something happened on that day? Asked one of the instructors in an accusatory tone. He was a handsome man, and was dressed more stylishly than the others. I immediately didn't like him. Lots of plaques with that date. Beginning of the big gap, I answered. Are you a detective or a reporter or something? Harbinger held up his hand and the other instructors shut up. Worse, he's an accountant. Harbinger nodded in my direction. Very astute of you, Pitt. I'll answer your question, but not today. Most of you in this room are not going to make it through training. Those folks get to walk away from this place and never look back. They don't need to know. Trust me, they don't want to know. For those of you who make it, I'll tell you the story personally, because I was there, and it affects every single hunter. It was the straw that broke the camel's back and got us shut down. It was the 100-year anniversary of the founding of the company, and it was one hell of a Christmas party. The room was quiet. Any more questions? No one else said a word. Okay, everybody grab your crap and follow me. I'll show you where you sleep, and then we get started. We have work to do.
Chapter 5. Over the last week, I had become very familiar with the compound. There was the two-story office building slash fortress, and several smaller buildings that served as barracks, classrooms, workshops, and armories. A few hundred yards away was the hangar, housing one medium plane and one strange-looking helicopter of foreign origin. Behind the asphalt runway, just far enough away so that the noise would not be distracting, were the shooting ranges. Bulldozers had pushed up huge berms of red clay soil to serve as backstops. A razor-wire-topped chain-link fence stretched around the entire property, intimidating and sharp wherever it had not been overtaken with kudzu vines. At that moment I was standing in front of a small group of other recruits on one of the shooting ranges. 10 yards away were 5 8-inch steel plates, each one about a yard apart. Snugly tucked into my shoulder was the rubber butt pad of a slicked-up Remington 870 pump-action 12-gauge shotgun. The muzzle was kept at the low ready, and my trigger finger was extended safely along the receiver. I could sense the instructor standing behind me, holding the packed timer right behind my head.
"Shooter ready?"
he asked, voice slightly amplified through my electronic earplugs. The MHI-issued plugs were the most advanced that I had ever used. Totally comfortable, and wired into a communications net, they would block all sounds over a certain decibel level, while normal conversation was still perfectly audible, even if slightly directionally distorted. I nodded.
"Stand by,"
the instructor said mechanically. I waited. The timer beeped. This was the moment I lived for. In one fluid motion, I deactivated the safety and pulled the shotgun into position. Leaning forward with my center of gravity, one with the shotgun, I focused on the plates and willed them to be shot. I had no conscious thought of controlling the trigger. Having practiced drills like this thousands of times, the muzzle automatically sought out the plates. With each shot, my arm pulled the pump without thought or hesitation. The barrel rose slightly, only to settle almost instantly on the next plate. I absorbed and rolled with the heavy recoil of the double-aught buckshot. I knew that each shot had been clean, even before the last payload of shot had impacted the steel surface. I lowered the gun as the last two plates fell with a clang.
"Holy shit."
The instructor's voice was incredulous as he glanced at the electronic timer. It was designed to pick up the sound of each shot and digitally record it. It was a very handy training device.
1.87 seconds. You did a dozer drill in 1.87 with a pump shotgun and full-power buckshot. That was unbelievable.
I stayed facing downrange. My personal best on this particular drill had been several years earlier in a match at 1.75, but that was with one of my personal guns that I had worked over myself. Contrary to popular myth, a shotgun pattern is not a huge, room-clearing boulder of death. At 10 yards, it is usually smaller than a basketball. The real key is learning how to be one with the recoil. I had been doing stuff like this since I was a little kid.
It sounded like it was full auto, one of the other newbies said.
Fluke, said another voice that I had seriously grown to dislike.
Have him do it again.
Okay,
said the instructor, a former U.S. Navy SEAL turned monster hunter named Sam Haven. He was our main weapons and tactics instructor. Sam was the walrus-mustached man, a burly guy with a penchant for Western wear, rodeo belt buckles, and Stetson hats. He was also a bad mofo, whom I would never on my best day want to mess with.
Load up!
Somebody else pushed the button to activate the pneumatic target system. The five plates reset themselves with a hiss. I decided to show off a little for the crowd. Since the action was open, I quickly plucked a spare round of buckshot from the elastic side saddle mounted on the shotgun's receiver. I dropped it into the chamber and instantly slammed the pump forward. Instinctively, my support hand moved to the bandolier of spare shells strapped across my chest. Grasping four cases, I palmed them under the loading port and rapid-fire shoved them in as if my hand itself was a spring-loaded mechanism. Snick, 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 snick. Four shells loaded in under 2 seconds. It was a trick used by three-gun competitors. We would often shoot in long field courses involving rifles, pistols, and shotguns. The shotgun portion sometimes consisted of 20 or even 30 separate targets. Since we were scored according to our total time, and since shotguns are low-capacity weapons of 5 to 9 shots, with some exceptions, the winners were the people who could keep their weapons loaded the fastest. Combine large groups of hyper-competitive, type A personality gun people, and I guarantee you will see some amazing and creative ways to do things. I heard another newbie say something about a magic trick. Not magic, my friend. Just the result of practicing until my thumbs were a mass of nerve-deadened scar tissue. I tucked the shotgun back into the correct position, positioned my feet, and squared off against the targets. I indicated my readiness to Sam. He leaned in close and spoke loud enough that he knew I would pick it up, but quiet enough that the rest of the class would not. His breath smelled of Copenhagen chewing tobacco.
You're gonna have to show me how you do that loading trick.
I grinned and answered,
Shooter ready.
Beep. This time I was really in the zone. The five shots came out as a continuous thunder of buckshot pelting steel to the ground. I lowered the smoking muzzle. Sam paused before saying the time.
1.82 seconds. Hot damn.
I could not help but gloat a little as I smiled for my nemesis, Grant Jefferson. The smug bastard had only been able to do it in 2.5, which was still pretty respectable, but not even close to as fast as mine. And the best part was that he knew it. He was the one who said my first run had been a fluke. Grant was not used to being bested at anything. I enjoyed watching as he stomped off in frustration. He did not like me, and the feeling was mutual. I handed the shotgun over for the next shooter. Grant was no newbie. He was a full-fledged member of MHI, and also one of our instructors, though he was the junior man on Harbinger's team. He had only come out to shoot in the hopes of showing us poor folks how it was done. Grant was totally my opposite. Lean and handsome, witty, charming, a product of the finest schools, and descended from the oldest established, as in super wealthy, New England families. He even had nice hair. He was the type of person everybody liked, and everybody wanted to be liked by. I wouldn't trust him as far as I could throw him. I thought he was a pompous ass from the moment I had met him, and I felt the primal and instinctual need to beat him up and take his lunch money. But the real reason that I hated his guts was that he was Julie Shackelford's boyfriend. Julie and I had only spoken briefly since my arrival at the compound, and that had been mostly a hi, how are you kind of thing. I had been totally swamped with training, and she was always occupied with one piece of business or another. It wasn't like she had ever given me any sort of indication that she liked me as anything other than as an employee, so I don't know why the thought of her dating a jerk like Grant bothered me so much. As much as I hated to admit it, I had a horrible crush on her. Sam interrupted my reverie.
"Pitt, I want you to tell everybody else how you shoot like that. I've told y'all what I know, and most of you still can't shoot for shit, you damn bunch of worthless derelicts, so let's get a fresh perspective. The pump is not your main weapon or even your first choice, but there are times when it is the absolute best thing you can have. We have a lot of specialty rounds that won't run through a semi. Every one of you needs to know how to use this thing because one of these days it might save your life."
Knowing how to do things because they might someday save your life was the mantra of our experienced monster hunters. The former SEAL spit a mighty wad of tobacco juices into the gravel. That was good. I noticed that most of the time he just swallowed the stuff. I could not be healthy.
"Okay, I looked over the group and thought about what to say. What I'm seeing from most of you is that you aren't really familiar with your weapons yet. You need to get to the point where your gun is an extension of your body. You don't think about shooting because if you're thinking, then you're going too slow. You just let the shot happen. Shotguns are more of an instinctive weapon than pistols or rifles. Some of you guys need to relax and let it flow."
I pointed at one of the other newbies, a muscular black man with dreadlocks.
"Trip here is a great example. When he uses the pump, it shoot, dramatic pause, pump, pause, shoot, pause, pump. You're thinking too hard. Thinking takes time. It's just boom and go. Like playing an instrument, you don't think about the notes, you just play."
He nodded in understanding. Trip and I had hit it off, and he was currently my bunkmate in the barracks. His real name was John Germain Jones, and he was at a loss to explain what his folks had been thinking when they had come up with that combination. The nickname that had stuck was Triple J, and after a week, most of us just called him Trip. Trip had been recruited by MHI after a voodoo priestess had placed a curse on his small Florida town and caused some of the recently deceased to rise from their graves to feast upon the brains of the living. He had solved the zombie problem with judicious use of a pickaxe. He was a great guy. So far, his only real challenge in training had been his lack of exposure to firearms, though he was coming along really well with the subguns. They just suited his personality more. Considering that a year ago he had been a high school chemistry teacher, he was actually one tough dude.
"Then the other problem I see is that some of you are just kind of recoil sensitive, like Holly," I pointed out the next newbie.
Holly Newcastle was an attractive young woman with bleached blonde hair and an amazing boob job. She never told the rest of us how she ended up at MHI, but apparently she had worked as a stripper, or as she preferred, exotic dancer, before being recruited. The rumors were that it had involved a hot lesbian vampire, but I'm pretty sure that that was just wishful thinking by most of the guys in the barracks. As far as I could tell, she had exactly zero experience with any sort of firearms, but she was coming along gradually. She really surprised me when it came to the class portion of our training. She had an amazing ability to soak up knowledge and monster-related trivia. She may have looked like the stereotype, but she was no dumb blonde. I had no doubt that whatever she had done to get herself recruited by MHI, she had done very well. "Holly, the shotgun kicks, but once you master the correct form, you learn to just flow with the recoil, and it's no big deal. It's all about proper fit and how you hold it. If you're doing it right, it doesn't hurt at all."
"So what you're saying, Z, is that it's kind of like sex? If it hurts, you must be doing it wrong?"
She smiled seductively and winked. I blushed. Everybody else laughed, including Sam the instructor.
pretty much. I had a sneaky feeling that Holly wanted me to help her with more forms than just her shotgunning. It's kind of a bummer that for a person with such a dark complexion, my cheeks turned red so easily. Seriously, though, fit is very important. We need to find you a stock that's a couple of inches shorter. I hurried along before anybody thought to make a nasty joke about that comment. I continued my demonstration to the other new recruits. We were an odd collection. Ages ranged from mid-40s all the way down to barely old enough to drink. We had people from all parts of the country and all walks of life. We had everything from an army ranger to a taxi driver, from a narcotics cop to a librarian, and we even had a plumber. Take my word for it, you do not want to hear the detailed account of his first monster encounter. Despite our differences, we all had a few things in common. Every single one of us had come face to face with something from mankind's darkest imagination, and every single one of us was a survivor. At the beginning of our training, we had been informed that not all of us would make it, and they had not been kidding. The experienced instructors made judgment calls as necessary, and many a recruit was sent packing with an extremely generous severance check and an admonition not to talk too freely about what they had learned. Other newbies quit on their own. Some could not handle the physical stress, others the mental. There was no real shame in quitting. Anyone was free to leave at any time. And many did. I thought about it a few times myself. I was too stubborn to admit it to anyone, but every day that I had been here, I had struggled with the idea of what we were doing. I was torn. Part of me loved the idea and the challenge, but the part of me that had sought to be normal for so long was having a real hard time adjusting to the fact that I was learning how to kill monsters for fun and profit. The physical training was difficult, though according to our former ranger, it was a total sissified cakewalk. Personally, my leg was still tender and weak, and the running was killing me. I hate running. I was still walking with a limp, and I had despised running when I was totally healthy. Running is for skinny people. Weapons and tactics was my favorite segment. Not just because it was what I had done for fun for most of my life anyway, but also because I excelled at it. Many of the newbies struggled through, while others would never have what it took to work as a well-coordinated team, armed with lethal weapons, operating seamlessly together under intense pressure. That was fine. We had been told early on that not all of us would end up as the tip of the spear on an actual fighting hunter team. There was plenty of other work that also needed to be done. Research, support, admin, technical stuff, and other jobs. But every employee of MHI was to be proficient enough that they could stand in as an emergency replacement if needed. Out of our current group, I was guessing that about half of us would be assigned to hunting teams. Not bad, considering that we had started with 40 recruits, and now we were down to only 20. There were a few I was not sure about, who could probably go either way. And then there were the last few, who, personally, I was not comfortable with even having loaded weapons anywhere near me. Some people just did not have the proper mindset to ever rise above mere proficiency with a firearm. The classroom sessions were by far the most educational for all of us, because regardless of what kind of bizarre background somebody might have hailed from, the things we were being taught were guaranteed to be new material. Earl Harbinger sat with his feet up on the desk. In one hand he held the remote control for the slideshow, and the other held a yardstick that he used to point out interesting things. The photos on the slideshow were disturbing, to say the least. There's many kinds of undead. Undead is basically a catch-all term for any being that's scientifically dead, yet still animated. They range from your basic zombie, which is nothing more than a flesh-eating corpse,
all the way up to your virtually invincible master vampires, and pretty much anything you can think of in between. You'll need to know them all, their strengths and especially their weaknesses. Click. This slide showed a large number of chewed-up corpses littering a suburban street. It could have been any town in the country. Some of the modest ranch-style homes in the background were on fire. Undead are our bread and butter. In North America alone, we average at least one incident involving them a month. Factor in South America and the Caribbean, and we probably have a hunter team working an undead outbreak at any given time. With your basic lower-level undead, the key is a swift response. They multiply like rabbits, and the denser the human population, the more danger there is. Click. The next slide appeared to have been taken with a cheap disposable camera at a really bad angle. The subject was a woman lunging with filthy hands outstretched toward the unseen photographer. Most of her face was missing, and her lower jaw consisted only of exposed bone, but she did not appear to notice. Her eyes were wide and hungry. Zombie. The Walking Dead. Not very fast, not very smart. They'll head straight for you. They never stop. They feel no pain. They never tire, and they never quit. Luckily, they're about as creative as broccoli. The real danger is their bite, as the guy taking this picture found out. A single bite is infectious, and the victim's destined to end up a zombie themselves. The worse the injury, the faster you die, the faster you come back. George Romero was an optimist. Yes, headshots work, but you've got to really damage their brains for a reliable stop. We had learned that oftentimes cultural and entertainment ideas about monsters had some basis in fact. "Where'd they come from?" one of the class asked. "Voodoo," muttered Trip. The 20 remaining newbies sat on metal folding chairs behind rickety plastic tables. We were in a small room located in the main building. The air conditioner kept us alive in the freshly arrived Alabama heat. "That's one possibility, and a good thing to keep in mind. If you can bag the person that animated the dead to begin with, by all means, do it. Animating the dead is a serious felony, and the feds usually pay a good reward for renegade witch doctors or mad scientists. I've got to keep going, though, because we have a lot to cover. All of this information is in your packets, and I'll get to specifics later. Today is just the overview. Last thing on zombies, Puff is usually about $5,000 a head, depending on the severity of the outbreak." Click. The thing in the picture had obviously once been a person, but was now a hunched and rotting pile of rags and jagged edges and pointed teeth. The creature held what appeared to be a human leg in its mostly skeletal hand. It looked as if its lunch had been rudely interrupted by the flash of the picture. "This is a ghoul. Think of it as a super zombie on crack. Much smarter, much faster, way harder to stop. Luckily, they're rare, which is a good thing because the one in this picture soaked up about 200 rounds before it finally quit kicking. Headshots don't usually work, though they tend to slow them down. Your best bet is to hammer them until you break down their skeletal structure to the point where they just can't fight anymore. Then burn them to be sure. They're usually found around cemeteries as their carrion feeders. Puff for a ghoul runs around 20K. Click. "This is a white, toughest of the zombie family, one of old Europe's least popular exports." This picture took me by surprise. Sure, the creature was as nasty as expected, appearing to be a normal man, except for his horribly distorted visage, sharp black teeth, and red eyes. But this picture caught my attention because it was an action shot. Julie Shackelford was in the corner of the frame, with a long spear in her hands, keeping the creature at bay while it clawed at her. She was wearing some sort of strange body armor that I did not recognize. Her dark hair had been captured flying wildly around her head like a halo,
and there was an intense look of fear and concentration on her face. She was frozen in mid-movement, gracefully lunging toward the claws of the undead beast. It was like a cover shot from Sports Illustrated, only this time the sport was mutant tag, and the penalty for losing was painful.